I have zero zinger suggestions because I don't know anything about this woman.
Mm.
More like peg me Noonan, but that doesn't make any sense. Give me information on her that I can zing with well, which to
I mean,
zing.
She, okay, very generic,
okay,
conservative op-ed type, but with sort of sparks of insanity.
All right, let's do it. Okay.
All right. Michael.
Peter.
What do you know about Peggy Noonan?
All I know is that if you have to keep bringing us back to the one book theory, I'm going to keep bringing us back to the one pundit theory.
So what do you actually know about Peggy Noonan? Do you know anything?
She's like one of these like center-right columnists, right? I mean, I really only hear about her when she's getting dunked on Twitter for like an extra dumb thing that she said. But in general, mm-hmm. she's just one of these like center-right people who just writes like dumb columns all the time.
Op-ed columnists truly are enigmatic in this way. You only ever find out about them when they've said something exceptionally stupid.
Yeah.
And if you just start reading their op-eds,
yeah,
it is tedious. It is awful.
It's the cosmic background microwave radiation of just like them saying dumb shit constantly.
Right. So she's an op-ed columnist for the Wall Street Journal. In a just world, I wouldn't have to say anything beyond that, but yeah. It's not the world we live in.
She's like the smart one or something, maybe.
She has her moments. She is okay. A talented writer. She can really hit a rhetorical flourish.
Okay.
She worked for Reagan. She is quintessential Reagan conservative. She idolizes and idealizes him, like, to this day. She's been around for a long time. She's very widely read. Still, she's very influential. I think she's worth covering for that reason. But also, she has these very, like, out there moments that are very, like, archetypal boomer brain.
Okay.
Like, if you've ever talked to, like, a conservative boomer who otherwise seems normal, every mm-hmm. now and then they'll say something and you're like, what? They'll be like,
yeah, you know,
Clinton killed that guy with his own hands.
Right.
And you're like, back up. What'd you just say?
So there's going to be some columns about like fluoride in the water. And like, that's when it all got bad.
It's like a little bit of Tom Friedman, a little bit of mm-hmm. Alex Jones. That's what you get.
Yeah.
So basically some quick background. She was a conservative her whole life. She said that like witnessing her classmates protest against the Vietnam War, which she thought was, quote, an essential part of America's struggle against communism.
Dude, hell
yeah.
That
was sort of like what solidified her conservatism.
Dude, did you have kids like this at your high school who were doing kids these days shit when they were like 16?
I remember when the Iraq War started, if anyone said anything critical, there was like a contingent of kids who like, I don't know, they were like 15 and acting like they served in the Marines or something.
The future army soldier kid from Vine. Yes. We had a guy, I still remember sitting next to this guy in like seventh grade math who was talking about how he didn't have any friends his own age because like people my age are like so immature. And then somehow later I was asking what TV shows he likes. He's like, well, I would recommend Frasier, but it's too sophisticated for someone like you.
Absolutely fucking burned you. Oh,
owned.
My God.
I know.
Just
got
wrecked.
Me.
Especially funny because I'm trying to think of a show that's more direct on the nose Mike Hobbs than Frasier.
Exactly. It's like, fuck off. Also, the gay brother that I had like one of my first crushes on. How dare you?
A nerdy show about like effete men living in Seattle. What what more do you want?
I know. Give me a fucking break. I hope that guy is well. I'm sure he's still doing the shtick now that's age appropriate.
Is the pronunciation of that effete or is it like effete or something? I never know.
Oh, effete is fine. I think it's either one.
Okay, sorry. After the Pret-A-Manger debacle.
Oh my fucking God.
We have to be careful.
That's on you, Peter. You let it stand.
Look.
You let it happen.
I didn't really know how to say it, but apparently everyone's like, oh my God, Michael has humiliated himself. It's actually Pret-A-Manger. Like, how you say Pret-A-Manger?
Also, a lot of British people were giving us shit about that, and they say fillet of fish.
Taco? Get out
of
here.
Yeah, fuck it. Mario?
All right. So, Peggy Noonan. She comes up writing and editing in radio during the 70s, has a brief stint teaching journalism at NYU. In 1981, she worked writing for Dan Rather at CBS for a bit.
Oh.
And then she really comes to prominence in 1984 when she joins the Reagan White House and writes a number of speeches for him and then goes on to write some for George H.W. Bush as well. She writes the fairly famous speech that Reagan gave after the Challenger shuttle explosion, for example, where he quoted, John McGee's line about slipping the surly bonds of earth and touching the face of God.
Okay.
She wrote Bush's Read My Lips, No New Taxes speech. I will say this. She is a good writer. She has these moments where she can really turn a phrase. She knows how to write. It's very nice coming off of, I don't know, like a Tom Friedman type.
Yeah.
You really do appreciate when someone can just write with a little bit of bit of pizzazz. And she really can.
Also, the core lesson of my own educational experiences was that the fastest way to convince people that you're smart without actually being that smart is to be a decent writer.
I do think that's sort of what's happening with Noonan, or at least the part of her brain that makes her smart at writing is not particularly useful when it comes to like analyzing the world or whatever.
Yes.
After Bush wins, she transitions back into writing and journalism. She publishes a bunch of books over the next decade and change. Mm. She's still publishing books. Writes a lot of generic stuff about Reagan and her time working alongside him. Her general perspective during the 90s is that Reagan is like the height of the American project, but the Clintons reflected a sort of cultural and political decay.
Oh my God.
She has a book about Reagan called When Character Was King, to give you a sense.
Okay.
And in the year 2000, she publishes one called The Case Against Hillary Clinton.
Oh, which I partly read for something. I think for our emails episode.
So I went to glance at this book just to see if there's anything interesting. And I got kind of hooked and read like, I don't know, 50% of it or something.
Yeah.
So this was published when Hillary was first running for Senate in New York. Mm-hmm. Very much an emblem of how much the right hates Hillary. Because like, I don't know, Noonan's writing all this dull, like Reagan was great sort of shit.
Mm-hmm.
And then you get this like furious polemic against Hillary at the same time. Here is her sort of high level of why she doesn't like Hillary Clinton.
She says she stands for what he stands for. Together, they stand for one thing, maximum and uninterrupted power for the Clintons. What they want is self-advancement, and what fuels them is a sense of self-importance. America is the platform for the Clintons' ambitions, not the focus of them. If it serves their advancement to take an action that is in the good of the country, they will certainly take it. If not, not. This is not for them a difficult choice, because it is not a choice. It is now merely a reflex. Yeah, this is a lot of words to say, like, he's running for president. He's seeking power.
Right.
Yeah.
This is, like, the most obvious criticism of, like, every politician on earth. I will also note Peggy Noonan dedicated her life during the Clinton years to making this argument. And during the Trump years, has gone a sort of different direction,
of course.
Right? And if you're going to make an argument about like selfish politicians who just want power and you're like not really going to focus on it for Trump, then I don't know what to tell you.
It's these like fake kind of content neutral arguments where it's like, I don't care about their politics. It's about the fact that they're seeking power. But like, it's not. You just don't like their politics. But there's this chicken shit thing where you don't just want to admit it.
Right.
So you like trick yourself into thinking that it's somehow about the fact that they're seeking power.
Now, I don't want to dig into the book too much, but I would like to note some of the more insane things about it. First, the dedication reads to Eleanor Roosevelt.
Nice. And that's such a flex, dude. That's great.
In her opening chapter, she talks about how Hillary appears to idolize Eleanor Roosevelt, but in fact is nothing like Eleanor Roosevelt because Eleanor is like a true believer who wanted to do good and Hillary is in it for herself.
Okay.
Hold on. Let me send you this.
She says, I do not channel Mrs. Roosevelt, but it's not hard to imagine her in your mind standing there in a ruffled cotton dress and stern black shoes. A fluty voice, the odd combination of heaviness and flutter, and yet something profound, a modesty. What would Eleanor think of Hillary? You can imagine her looking down and saying, she seems a strong woman, certainly, which is always a good thing to see, but one senses there is something strange there. And I'm afraid one senses it with both of them. Tell me, what does she actually stand for?
Hmm.
Yeah, this is again, it's like kind of nice, mellifluous Oprah's book club writing, but it's not smart.
No.
She's just wish casting this like person I like not liking Hillary.
She's just fantasizing about Eleanor Roosevelt talking shit about Hillary Clinton.
Yeah.
It's just pure fantasy. And it's not the only time in the book where she's doing this. There are many times where Noonan just imagines a fictional dialogue that's meant to make Hillary look bad. At one point, she writes a fictional account of Hillary's own thoughts that goes on for 7 pages.
It's filibuster.
Yeah, it's all just like Hillary thinking about political strategy, and I guess it's meant to portray her as like calculating and shallow. But like, it's made up.
Yeah.
You're just imagining Peggy like furiously writing this, like going 7 pages, like red in the face by page 5, being like, I bet she's fucking thinking about politics because she's such a bitch.
Who else would hate her? MLK would hate her. Mahatma Gandhi would hate her. Harriet Tubman would hate her. Each one gets a chapter.
You wonder what Christ would say about Hillary Clinton. There's a one-sided fictional conversation with a childhood friend of Noonan's, and the childhood friend is thinking about voting for Hillary, and that goes on for 14 pages.
Oh my God.
There's another point where Noonan describes a speech that Hillary made to Hollywood executives about how they need to reduce the amount of obscenity in media. And the twist is that at the end of it, Noonan reveals that the speech was actually a dream that she had and never actually happened.
Oh my God.
That speech, that fake speech goes on for 15 pages.
No way. Jesus Christ.
The book is 181 pages long. Again, I did not read the whole book. So this is just what I caught. But if you just add up what I just described, that is 20% of the book
being fake
dialogue designed to make Hillary look bad.
I love that all roads on this podcast lead back to you defending Hillary Clinton. Your dream when you started this show.
But this is the problem with Hillary, is that I find her truly demonic, and yet her
and
enemies
yet,
are worse, somehow worse.
I know.
I also want to just quickly say about that fake speech to Hollywood executives, like Noonan presents it like it's a real twist. Like it was all a dream. She never said that. But it's very clear partway through it that it's complete fantasy because the Hollywood executives start standing up and it's like, Ted Turner is like, you are objecting to obscenity on television, but your husband is the true problem here because he had us talking about oral sex. Like, you're just like, what is this? What is this fake speech thing she's doing? And then she's like, I guess this was a dream I had where Hillary Clinton didn't suck ass.
But it's funny because Clinton also did do like violence in video games shit. Like she was on board with this. This like Marilyn Manson is to blame for Columbine and stuff.
Yeah.
So you don't actually have to make up a speech of her echoing right-wing talking points on like cultural decay. That's what's so fucked up about like these sort of center-left / center-right Democrats is they're actually doing a lot of Republican shit, but they never actually get credit for it.
Right.
Because none of the columnists who like do this like oppo research do any actual research.
So in the year 2000, that same year, Noonan becomes a featured columnist for the Wall Street Journal, where she remains to this day. The real standout element of her work is that at least once every couple of years, she does something truly unhinged.
Mm.
I think the first example of that was from the pre-9/11 era, late Clinton administration, Elian Gonzalez.
Ooh, here it goes.
Elian Gonzalez was a 6-year-old Cuban refugee who set out to America on a raft with his mother. His mother died on the journey. He arrives alone on a raft, and there is a huge dispute over whether he should be returned to Cuba to be with his father, as dictated by international law, or whether he should remain in the United States with, like, distant relatives in Miami. This was very high profile. Fidel Castro is publicly demanding Elian's return, becomes very political stateside as well. Eventually, the Clinton administration very famously sends in federal agents to take him from his relatives and deliver him to his father. Here is some of Peggy Noonan's speculation in the Wall Street Journal about why Bill Clinton would do this.
Was Mr. Clinton being blackmailed? The Star report tells us of what the president said to Monica Lewinsky about their telephone sex, that there was reason to believe that they were monitored by Foreign Intelligence Service. Naturally, the service would have taped the calls to use in blackmail of the president. Maybe it was Mr. Castro's intelligence service or that of a Castro friend. Is it irresponsible to speculate? It is irresponsible not to. Peggy.
Is it irresponsible to speculate? It is irresponsible not to. put that on my fucking tombstone.
It would be bad journalism not to make up some random shit for which there's no evidence.
It's very funny that she takes this one line from Clinton talking to Lewinsky, which is like, we need to think about the fact that this is probably being monitored by foreign intelligence, which is obviously not like a specific reference to Castro.
Yeah,
he's just being like,
no.
I'm the president. People are probably monitoring these calls.
Or he's just trying to get laid, which is also fairly plausible.
Yeah, he's like, that would sound sexy.
Yeah, that would sound cool.
If I say that foreign intelligence is listening. There's a section of the column subtitled, What Would Reagan Do?
Okay,
which
of
is
course.
Where Noonan speculates about how Reagan would have handled this.
It's like he quietly puts down the Dostoevsky that he's reading.
Yeah.
And like,
right.
He takes a break from saving orphans to address right. this concern. Yeah.
He pledges allegiance, first of all, just to get his head clear. So again, to preface this, understand Elian Gonzalez was found surrounded by a school of dolphins. And so a lot of like Christians suggested that these were actually angels or something similar, right? Noonan herself alludes to it earlier in the piece. So here's Noonan.
Oh my God. Mr. Reagan would not have dismissed the story of the dolphins as Christian kitsch, but seen it as possible evidence of the reasonable assumption that God's creatures had been commanded to protect one of God's children.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's probably A, not true that he was like surrounded by a ring of dolphins.
Yeah.
And B, like not a sign of God in that everyone else died and he's the only one who survived.
When the dolphins all spelled out Jesus is real, that's when it really became reasonable to think that perhaps this was God's work.
And also Ronald Reagan would believe in that.
I feel like she wants to be like, the dolphins were sent by God, but she's like, she's somewhat aware that that's going to come off as weird. So she's like, I bet Reagan would believe that the dolphins right. were sent by God.
It would be irresponsible not to speculate that the dolphins were sent by God to rescue this child.
I want that line to stick with us. I feel like I'm just going to throw that in at the end of various things I say. All right. So Noonan gets the Wall Street Journal gig at the best possible time because it's right before 9/11.
Yeah.
If there was ever a time to be a vapid right-wing pundit in this country, right? It's in that like post 9/11 haze, like empty platitudes about America, check, talk a little shit about Muslims, check.
The whole country became the Wall Street Journal editorial page for like 3 years.
Right.
Yeah.
So of course, Noonan is a huge Iraq war booster. I don't think she said anything like exceptionally stupid or bloodthirsty by the standards of this time.
Right.
I almost skipped this stuff, but I do feel like we all need the occasional very quick reminder about how stupid and wrong all of these people were about like the largest political event of our lifetimes.
And they're all still employed, still doing exactly the same thing. Great
right.
stuff.
It took 1 week of the war for her to write a column where she effectively said we had won, stating,
right.
and I quote, Iraq's liberation will be the biggest good thing to happen since 9/11.
Oh, what?
Yeah, she's making it seem like 9/11 was a big good thing.
Peggy. Ooh.
So even ignoring the phrase biggest good thing, which I
which does sound like a book that a child wrote.
The biggest good thing I own is probably my air hockey table.
Yeah.
Anyway, substantively, she says, quote, we are about to startle and reorder the world. We are going to win this thing. And in the winning of it, we are going to re-inspire civilized people across the globe. We're going to give the world a lift.
LYFT. It's actually sponsored content.
Like, it's so funny how fucking wrong they were. Like,
yeah, it's wild.
Actually, we're going to create a power vacuum that's going to result in, like, what's basically a terrorist state that lasts half a decade. But, you know, go off. Sure. Maybe we'll inspire civilized people, whatever the fuck that means.
In this completely foreseeable way, too.
In, like, later years, she would write about Iraq as if it were a blunder. In 2010, she said that Washington, quote, took its eye off the ball in Afghanistan, turning its focus and fervor toward invading Iraq.
I love this.
Like, Washington took its eye off the ball. Not me, Peggy Noonan, at the Wall Street Journal.
Just quietly change your mind on something and then have no reflection whatsoever about like what you did wrong or like how you could do things differently the next time.
It's, I don't know. There's, I mean, that's also just so emblematic of how all of these people pivoted in the late aughts to be like, what a devastating mistake you all made.
Yeah. Dude, I actually remember, speaking of vivid memories from youth, I remember there was like a summer when everybody came back and they were all just like, I never liked the New Kids on the Block. The New Kids on the Block are stupid. These were people with like New Kids on the Block, like denim jackets that their parents spent like $400 on 3 months before. Even at that age, I was like, I feel like I'm being gaslit. Like everyone was really into this and now they're all pretending like they weren't. Also gay marriage.
Yeah, no, that gay marriage one is real. Mm. I was a little too young for New Kids on the Block hype. This is like the only time that our like 2 year age gap makes a difference.
Yeah, if you say the word Pokemon, I have no idea what you're talking about. And if I say razor sharp slap bracelets, you have no idea what I'm talking about.
So for the next segment, I am going to share with you the opening line from a Peggy Noonan column. And I want you to guess what she's talking about. I am even going to give you the date. Okay. I've sent you the line.
She says, we are in the midst of the worst Washington scandal since Watergate.
The date is May 17th, 2013.
13.
Now, clearly, you remember the worst scandal since Watergate.
Yeah.
Hitting in May 2013. So just whenever it comes to you, let me know.
The thing is, I know you want to stump me with this, but I actually remember this was President Obama at some public event pronounced it Pret a Manger. Thousands of voices screamed out and were silenced. No, was this something about like the Ebola response?
No, the scandal that Peggy is referring to is the IRS targeting of Tea Party activists for audits. Do you remember this?
This could be a whole bonus episode. This was good, like next level derangement.
Yeah, for everyone who hasn't heard of this, and that's probably most people because it's fake.
It was not the worst scandal in Washington of all time, no.
She's claiming that the IRS targeted conservative groups and individual conservative activists for audits in the lead up to the 2012 presidential election. Basically, what happened is conservative groups started complaining that their applications for nonprofit 501c status were being unfairly scrutinized by the IRS. Mm-hmm. Peggy is adding another conspiratorial layer here that I want to just poke at quickly, which is that the IRS is targeting individual conservatives for regular tax audits.
Right.
This is like a big accusation because nonprofit status is handled by a specific IRS office and tax audits are separate. So if they're both targeting conservatives, we're no longer talking about one thing. We are talking about the Obama administration targeting conservatives, right? So here's what she says. This is her evidence based on other reporting of conservative activists being targeted for tax audits.
She says, the journal's Kim Strassel recorded an Idaho businessman named Frank Vandersloot who donated more than $1 million to groups supporting Mitt Romney. He found himself last June, for the first time in 30 years, the target of IRS auditors. His wife and his business were also soon audited. Hal Schertz, a Georgia physician, also came to the government's attention. He told ABC News, it's odd that nothing changed on my tax return and I was never audited until I publicly criticized Obamacare. Franklin Graham, son of Billy, told Politico he believes his father was targeted. A conservative Catholic academic who has written for these pages faced questions about her meager freelance writing income. Many of these stories will come out, but not as many as there are. People are not only afraid of being audited, they're afraid of saying they were audited. Wait, so this is just like rich people getting audited, right?
This is literally just four audits.
Yeah.
Right. The claim here is that there's a vast conspiracy to audit conservative activists. Her evidence of that is four audits, one of which is like secondhand about Billy Graham told by his son. There's nothing there. We don't even know if it's an audit. To be clear, at this point, there were something like 1.5 million audits per year. So to say that this is insufficient evidence is to put it pretty fucking lightly. What's actually happening is that there's this background scandal that's actually getting attention in Washington about conservative groups and their nonprofit status being heavily scrutinized. And so conservatives are just trying to squeak in a broader, like all this other shit that makes it look like a broader conspiracy. Like, ooh, I think they're individually targeting activists too. There's absolutely no fucking evidence about it.
And also the people most likely to cheat on their taxes are small business owners because it's really easy to cheat on your taxes.
Right. It's also harder to do those taxes.
Exactly. So like the fact that this Idaho businessman who gave away $1 million is getting audited is really not that weird. Like they should be auditing people who are at the highest risk of cheating on their taxes.
Right, right.
So was that it? That was the whole scandal? Just like four people got audited? And then she's like, there's more coming.
She then, let me send you the next paragraph.
Okay. She says, it is not even remotely possible that all this was an accident, a mistake. Again, only conservative groups were targeted, not liberal. It is not even remotely possible that only one IRS office was involved. Ooh, it goes deep. Lois Lerner, who oversees tax-exempt groups for the IRS, was the person who finally acknowledged, under pressure of a looming investigative report, some of what the IRS was doing. She told reporters the actions were the work of frontline people in Cincinnati, but other offices were involved, including Washington. It is not even remotely possible the actions were the work of just a few agents. This was more systemic. It was an operation. The word was out. Get the Democratic Party's foes.
So, a couple things. First, she is quickly pivoting back into the nonprofit status stuff after talking about the individual audits, which she will never mention again in this column.
Okay.
But she's, again, alleging that not only is this a broad-ranging conspiracy, but that there is no way it's not.
She says it's not remotely possible like three times. So maybe she's not that good of a writer, or maybe she's in some sort of fugue state.
Well, she's trying to really drive it home. It's not remotely fucking possible.
Is she on ketamine? It would be irresponsible not to speculate.
It's not it's not remotely possible that I'm in a K-hole right now. What actually happened here is quite simple. In 2010, the Supreme Court handed down Citizens United, which opened the doors to a ton of political money. This results in a surge of applications for 501c status, especially 501c4, which are social welfare organizations. This gets reported on. That brings concern that some of these organizations are potentially abusing their tax-exempt status, and there are calls for the IRS to clarify the rules and look at these organizations a little more closely.
All right.
So what the IRS does is start flagging nonprofit applications where the name or description has certain political keywords. They flag applications that include Tea Party and Patriot, as well as Progressive and Occupy and Medical Marijuana and a bunch of others.
Okay.
This all comes out through testimony on top of the fact that the commissioner of the IRS throughout all of this was a Bush appointee. And it turns out that the person responsible for identifying the Tea Party group specifically was a self-identified conservative Republican. So like you would think that the controversy would be over.
Yeah,
right?
There's an explanation.
Right. Here's the explanation. The conservative groups were sort of right that they were being scrutinized, but they were wrong that this was a targeted operation directed at one side of the aisle, right?
Right.
Cut and dry. But even after all of this comes out, Noonan keeps doubling down. She writes a column called Why This Scandal is Different.
Okay.
I'm going to send you a quick paragraph from that.
It's not remotely possible.
It's not remotely possible that I embarrassed myself with my previous columns about this.
She says, what is historic about this scandal, what makes it unique and uniquely dangerous, is that it is different in kind from previous IRS scandals. Okay, she's just saying the same thing. In the past, it was always elite versus elite, power guys using the agency against other power guys. This scandal is different because it's the elite versus the people. It is an entrenched and fearsome power versus regular citizens. Dude, that guy gave $1 million to a political candidate.
Yep.
This is not like the people. This is Franklin Graham and Billy Graham.
To give you a sense of who the impacted nonprofits were, one of them was Crossroads GPS, founded by Karl Rove.
Nice.
They spent $70 million in the 2012 election cycle. Another was True the Vote, a vote suppression organization that sends volunteers to polling places in liberal areas to, like, quote unquote, monitor potential voter fraud.
Mm-hmm.
This is sort of like early glimpses into what's now very on the surface, which is like the way that conservatives present themselves as if they are populist, no matter who they actually are.
Yeah. Also, she's like, oh, this is the first time the government has gone after the people.
Right.
And it's like, are you familiar with, like, the Lavender Scare or, like, the bombing in Philadelphia? Like,
I mean, the George W. Bush White House audited the NAACP. So, yeah. Like, that was, like, it was, like, yeah. 5 years before this. Like, this is, I mean, this is the work of someone who doesn't understand this scandal and also doesn't understand the basic operation of government historically, yeah. Right? Like no political understanding, no historical understanding.
This is also something we see with these columns all the time. It's not like something happens and they're like, okay, I need to understand this. Like, how can I talk to experts? How can I like really unravel for myself and other people? Like what should we take away from this? No, they just sit down and start writing.
One thing that op-ed columnists could do is be like, here's what we know. Let's put this in some historical and political context.
Yeah.
But she doesn't know enough to do that in an interesting way. All she can do is be like, I think this is the worst thing since Watergate somehow. And just to sort of tie the bow here, there was a congressional report about this that came out a few years later that pretty much confirmed everything I said, that like the IRS had been doing this in various forms for some years. And I think like the broad conclusion everyone drew was like their approach here was a little bit sloppy, like just using random keywords, but absolutely no evidence that there was partisan targeting.
I think one thing that Democrats can learn from Republicans is how good Republicans are in taking the gripes from their constituents and turning them into political scandals, right? Because it sounds like this is just some like people complaining like, man, I got audited this year. And then before you know it, there's like years long investigations and these big investigative reports. And like it becomes like a known scandal.
And I mean, it's important that you mentioned their constituents, because their constituents in this case and almost all cases are in fact rich elites.
Yeah.
Right. But it gets laundered through Peggy Noonan, who literally is like, this is about the government versus the people.
It's the people.
So next, I want to turn to her coverage of Donald Trump in 2016. She was never a huge Trump fan.
Mm-hmm.
She found him, of course, crass and immature. But she was one of a handful of mainstream media figures who took him and his campaign seriously, which got her a lot of praise once he won. She also seemed to understand very early that Trump reflected a sort of existential crisis for the Republican establishment. She very correctly predicted the death of like the neoconservative wing of the GOP.
Okay.
She got a Pulitzer in 2017 for her coverage of the election cycle. I mean, they fucking hand those out.
You have two. Whatever.
I stole one from Hamilton Hall. So I think that the notable thing about her coverage, after going through all of the pieces that got her the Pulitzer, was that she claimed to understand Trump's popularity, but I don't think she really did. She was one of the main purveyors of the idea that his popularity was due to the rise of marginalized and disaffected voters.
That's what she wants to be true, definitely.
All right, sending you something else.
She says, there are the protected and the unprotected. The protected make public policy. The unprotected live in it. The unprotected are starting to push back powerfully. The protected are the accomplished, the secure, the successful, those who have power or access to it. They are protected from much of the roughness of the world. More to the point, they are protected from the world they have created. Again, they make public policy and have for some time. This is my thing about how Republicans absolutely believe in things like structural discrimination. They just don't think it's happening to like black people and trans people.
Yeah.
Because she's basically saying like there are power structures in society where like some people are insulated from public policy and they're essentially imposing it on other people, which is like a fundamentally left-wing critique and fundamentally a true one. But then she's only levying this complaint on behalf of people who are not like the downtrodden on a relative scale, right?
Right.
Trump voters are more affluent than Clinton voters in 2016.
Don't spoil it.
Oh, sorry. Okay, we're leading up to that.
I mean, I think we all sort of know that, but all right, I'm going to send you another.
If you are an unprotected American, one with limited resources and negligible access to power, you have absorbed some lessons from the past 20 years' experience of illegal immigration. You know the Democrats won't protect you, and the Republicans won't help you. Both parties refuse to control the border. The Republicans were afraid of being called illiberal, racist, or losing a demographic for a generation. The Democrats wanted to keep the issue alive to use it as a wedge against the Republicans and to establish themselves as owners of the Hispanic vote. I was wondering when we'd get to the racism section. Every portrait of a conservative.
I'm about to send you more, but I just wanted to pause here because, like, Republicans cannot fathom any reason beyond pure political maneuvering to support immigration.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Like, you still see this today. They think that, like, liberal immigration policies are just a way to secure Democratic votes because they actually cannot comprehend a politics predicated on human empathy.
This is yet another thing, too. She's also doing this, like, both parties are corrupt thing, mm-hmm, while pushing Republican policies.
Right.
This rhetoric is very helpful to people because it makes you seem like you're not partisan. But fundamentally, she is defending people who voted for the Republican president. And Republican president has, like, extremely xenophobic policies on immigration.
Send you a little more.
Oh, God. She says, many Americans suffered from illegal immigration, its impact on labor markets, financial costs, crime, the sense that the rule of law was collapsing. But the protected did fine. More workers at lower wages. No effect of illegal immigration was likely to hurt them personally. It was good for the protected. But the unprotected watched and saw. They realized the protected were not looking out for them, and they inferred that they were not looking out for the country either. This is fucked. Suffered from illegal immigration.
Yeah, so this is one of the dominant narratives coming out of the 2016 election cycle, right? That, like, Trump had corralled these disaffected voters who had been overlooked by American elites and were being negatively impacted by these policies. Noonan doesn't say white working class in this particular column, but this is very conceptually similar to that argument, right? That he was able to rally this group. Over the next few years, a bunch of research was done about the demographics of the voters who went to Trump. And this narrative basically falls apart entirely because it turns out that poorer people, including poorer white people, favored Hillary over Trump.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
It's true that Trump won among the white working class quite substantially, but if you drill down, members of the white working class who self-described as being in worse financial shape actually went for Hillary by large margins, something like 70%.
Right.
So Noonan is particularly focused here on illegal immigration, but there's research showing that even though Trump supporters tended to be more upset about immigration, being impacted by economic competition with immigrants did not predict support for Trump in 2016.
Right.
What actually predicted support for Trump, according to what is now a large number of studies, is heightened racial and cultural resentment.
Yeah.
So yeah. We went through this whole cycle where a lot of people were like, damn, Trump and his supporters seem really racist. And then you had this, like, rehabilitation campaign by Noonan and others like her to say, like, no, these are people with legitimate concerns who are tired of being cast aside as racists and overlooked. And then the actual data comes out and it's like, oh no, they were racist. Sorry.
This is something you guys talk about on 5-4 all the time. This, like, lawyer brain thing. Mm-hmm. Trump was very obviously racist. A lot of his supporters were driven by racial animus. And there's this entire, like, tranche of center left to center right columnists who were, like, trying to make it more defensible than it was.
Right. I think what was happening on the right is that you had a period that really stretches back to the 90s where the rhetoric among the base was increasingly heated and radical. By the time you hit 2016, fervently anti-immigrant, anti-Muslim, just aggressively racist in those regards. And that created a disconnect with the establishment, right? And that's where this narrative comes from, that they were being overlooked, right?
Yeah.
Because in fact, it's true that to some degree, there was a disconnect where your median Republican senator was probably not as openly racist as the base. And so Trump enters into that space to sort of, like, resolve that tension and bring the establishment to where the base is. Mm-hmm. That's sort of, like, the role Trump plays in American politics. Now, what Noonan's problem is here is that she's being like, well, these people have legitimate concerns and they're being cast aside as racist. The exact opposite is true.
Yeah, no.
The exact opposite is true. They are, in fact, racists who are being treated as if they have legitimate concerns and they don't.
Yeah. And also this whole thing of, like, the forgotten Americans or whatever. Every election in my entire lifetime has been about the white working class and the loss of manufacturing and how there's no family farms anymore. It's all these people's issues, like rural issues, because of the Electoral College.
Right, but they thought that that coverage was not racist enough. That's what Trump was bringing to the table.
Right, because they're like, you want these economic policies. And these actual voters are like, no, we want our communities to stay white. And everyone is just still insisting on hearing that as like, oh, these are economic concerns.
Right.
And like
right.
most of these voters could not be clearer about the fact that these are not economic concerns, because if they were economic concerns, they wouldn't be voting for Republicans.
Right.
So either these people are uninformed about like the policies and wishes of the Republican Party, or they're voting due to something else. And that something else is the thing they keep telling you they are voting right. on. They do not like the country becoming more diverse.
Right. Trump rolls in like, we hate Mexicans and we're going to keep Muslims yeah. out. And everyone's like, yay. And Peggy's like, you know what this is really about?
It's really free trade agreements. Yeah. No.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
It's like, this is fucked up to like cancel my grandma like this. But my grandma and her like part of the exurb of Seattle that she lives in, she'll talk about a neighborhood is like, oh, it's a bad neighborhood. And it's like, do you mean that there's like visibly like Mexican people there?
Right.
Like, that's what she means by like, it's a bad neighborhood. It's not, she's not reading like crime rates, right? She just like sees minorities and thinks that it's like a blighted
right.
area.
Right.
And I feel like that's how a lot of people just perceive the world around them.
So Peggy has basically spent the last few years with her primary beat being like the slow death of the traditional GOP under Trumpism. She hasn't said anything particularly new on this point, at least as far as I can tell.
Nah.
But I do want to check in with her sort of round the bend here. And so let's talk about a Peggy piece from 2024. On May 2nd, she published a column called What I Saw at Columbia's Demonstration.
Oh, didn't we read from this already?
No, but you read from one, you read from...
Yeah. Someone should make a zinger about that.
Send in you something.
The demonstrations, which sometimes became riots, clarified some things, maybe for the first time in generations. America is a country of First Amendment rights, whether the students love our Constitution or not. It is a nation that supports the right to gather and protest. It respects the right to yell and write and put out the truth as you see it. It understands and accepts peaceful demonstrations, but it doesn't respect breaking our laws. It doesn't support violence as a tool or tactic and will move against it. This could have been written after the Stonewall riots.
I love this paragraph because literally every sentence is materially incorrect.
Yeah.
Like, find me a sentence here that doesn't have a terrible error.
Yeah.
The demonstrations, which sometimes became riots, literally didn't happen.
Yeah, no.
America is a country of First Amendment rights. Nah. Mm-hmm. It's a nation that supports the right to gather and protest almost... like, just flat out untrue. People hate protests. It respects their right to yell. I'm sorry, but the fact that the protesters were chanting was like the heart of multiple columns we read in our Columbia episode about why these are like uncouth protests, right?
The rhymes.
And the idea that America doesn't support violence as a tool or tactic. I don't know what to tell you. You like this woman just needs to read a history book of any type, just like a basic high school civics book about America. It would be so useful for her.
Also, Peter, I can't believe you skipped the part where she's like, I support the students, whether they love the Constitution or hate the Constitution. I love the students who love our country and also want to burn it to the ground.
She's also being like, look, everyone loves peaceful protests. Unfortunately, I've never seen one in my life. Like that's what she's doing, right?
Yeah.
All right. So I do want to just send you to the heart of this piece, which I'm sure you've read and was making the rounds because it's pitch perfect. Peggy.
Oh, yeah. I did see this. I was at Columbia hours before the police came in and liberated Hamilton Hall from its occupiers. Unlike protesters of the past, who were usually eager to share with others what they thought and why, these demonstrators would generally not speak to me or make eye contact with members of the press or, as they say, corporate media. I was on a bench taking notes as a group of young women, all in sunglasses, masks, and keffiyehs, walked by. Friends, please come and say hello and tell me what you think, I called. They marched past, not making eye contact, save one, a beautiful girl of about 20. I'm not trained, she said, which is what they're instructed to say to corporate media representatives who will twist your words. I'm barely trained. You're safe, I called. And she laughed and half halted, but her friends gave her a look, and she conformed.
She conformed.
It's very funny for someone who works at a fucking like Rupert Murdoch owned newspaper to put corporate media in quotes. And also like, I'm barely a reporter. You can talk to me.
Right.
But like you are here talking shit about them and saying that they're conforming based on nothing. So like, yeah, if they talked to you, you would have twisted it out of context.
The point of the story is that she tried to trick a student into talking to her by pretending not to be a professional columnist. And the student didn't go for it. And she's like, what a conformist. But the other thing here and this is actually what we didn't talk about it in the Columbia episode, is that she's complaining about the masks a little bit, that all these students are masked. Yeah. And earlier in the column, she calls them cowards for masking. And this is another common thing. Now, of course, why are these students masking up? Well, to protect their future careers, potentially. And also because there are absolute lunatics doxing them and parading their identities around the internet, so that not only will they have their careers impacted, but so that potentially violence could be inflicted upon them. Yeah. So sorry that your side is so aggressive and psychotic that these students are trying to protect their identities. I guess that makes them cowards for being scared of you, of all of you.
It's also so typical of these center right columnists, where it's like the breach of decorum is wearing the masks, not the reason why they have to wear the masks.
Also, I will say, they'll be the police had to come in with riot shields. And it's like, how come the way that the police protect themselves is counts against the protesters? But also when the protesters protect themselves, it counts against the protesters. Is there anything that can happen here that doesn't somehow count against the protesters? The way that this column ends is, the people of my liberal left town were relieved to see the NYPD come in, drag the protesters away, restore order, and let people clean things up. People want peacefulness. They want to go about their lives. It's not too much to ask.
Dude, I love this thing where it's like, I'm all for peaceful protest in general, in the abstract, but any specific left-wing protest, I find an excuse to be against it.
Right. I also want to point out that in the prior quote, she referred to the liberation of Hamilton Hall from its occupiers. It's a fucking building, lady.
Finally. Yeah, two windows got broken.
The liberation.
Emotional scars.
Let Hamilton Hall be breathe free. What are you talking about? well, that is all I have about Peggy Noonan.
Those are the only three things she's been wrong about. Everything else is fine.
The book about Hillary was unhinged, but was it wrong? That's a different story.